Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we're only a few weeks away from the presidential election, and now the race is a horse race.
And as people look at the choice they have to make to select a president, Mark, it might be a good time to remind folks that they might be selecting the future of healthcare in America as well. Depending on who wins the election, the healthcare reform law may be somewhat in jeopardy, at least certain elements of it.
A lot of historians and policy analysts are looking at this election as the single biggest referendum on a piece of social legislation since FDR's New Deal won the day in 1936.
And I would say, Mark, it's been kind of a crash course in educating the American public about the healthcare system and the healthcare issues over these last months. So it's pretty clear healthcare, the future of Medicaid and Medicare, will continue to be very important elements of the discussion in this path towards the election, as these areas could look very different in the future depending on the outcome.
There's quite a lot at stake, Margaret, but there are numerous changes underway as a result of the Affordable Care Act, and many of these reform initiatives will continue no matter what the outcome of the election.
And our guest today is an individual who can speak to some dramatic and innovative changes underway at the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the federal department that oversees Medicare, Medicaid, the Federal Drug Administration, and other organizations that have a profound impact on healthcare in this country.
We're going to be speaking with Brian Sivak, who is the Chief Technology Officer at HHS. Having taken over last year from Todd Park, he's overseeing the department's effort to advance the power of technology and data to improve the health and welfare of the nation.
Mr. Sivak has an impressive background, having created successful tech startups, and he'll be talking about the tremendous amount of innovation underway now at HHS using new tools to harness and then liberate health data and make it more accessible to all Americans.
And we'll also hear from factcheck.org's Lori Robertson, who has a long list of comments made during the recent debates that need correcting.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows featuring thought leaders in health reform and innovation by Googling us at CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to our interview with Brian Sivak in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. The presidential race is locked in a dead heat heading into the final stretch of the election. The second of three debates in a town hall format this week pitted a more engaged President Obama against an emboldened Governor Romney, both of whom focused their attentions on matters of health care, Medicaid, and Medicare, among many topics covered. No matter who wins in this election, Medicare looms large as a problem that needs attention. The threat of insolvency has to be dealt with at some point in the near future by whomever takes the helm in the next turn, and whether the Affordable Care Act stays or goes is also in the balance. Soda companies are trotting out the big guns in New York, where the mayor's proposed ban on large sugary sodas is poised to go into effect in March of next year. Lawyers representing the soda industry and several restaurant groups in New York have filed suit in the state Supreme Court, saying the New York City Health Department did not have the unilateral authority to approve the mayor's proposal banning the sale of sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces in restaurants and public venues. And the reason for the large soda ban, Mayor Bloomberg is adamant in creating public policy that will stem the rising tide of obesity. In spite of these Herculean efforts, a report just out from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation predicts that over half of the nation will be obese by 2030, unless a major public health initiative is passed. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
We're speaking today with Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Sivak recently served as the Chief Innovation Officer for the state of Maryland and was Chief Technology Officer for the District of Columbia. He got his start in the private sector as an IT entrepreneur and is co-founder of several successful startups, including Electric Knowledge, which created one of the world's first natural language speaking search engines. Mr. Sivak has also been a longtime promoter of code sharing and open source methods of expanding IT innovation. Brian, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
You know, your job at Health and Human Services is to harness the power of data, technology, and innovation to improve health and well-being of our nation. And you took over from Todd Park, who initiated that role, and you're monitoring everything from healthcare options for millions of Americans, from keeping food safe to infectious disease outbreaks at bay. So tell us a little bit about the programs like healthdata.gov as well as the health data warehouse, and how they're helping HHS shift to a more open and transparent government.
Sure. One of the most amazing assets that we have here at the Department of Health and Human Services is really the vast quantity of data. And, you know, it's been realized for a while now that this asset really needs to be leveraged to a greater extent. And so, as, you know, you mentioned a few years ago, my predecessor, Todd Park, came in and really started focusing on getting this information out to the public, to the entities that could actually take advantage of this, entrepreneurs, insurance companies, providers, you know, anyone in the system, actually consumers, I mean, anybody who touches the healthcare system at all. We, over the last few years, have undertaken a fairly significant program to liberate this data, which really means changing the default setting inside HHS from one of sort of protection of this asset to one of release of this asset. And we've done a great job, I think, to this point of really changing that default. The, I would say, most recent manifestation of this is the healthdata.gov website, which is sort of the second version of our data warehouse. And we're building this actually all on open source technology. We, in the next couple of weeks, will be releasing our code base to the public on GitHub so that anybody can use this for themselves, contribute code, you know, improve the system itself. But internally, the whole idea is that we're making a system that should be easy for people to interact with in order to upload their data sets or the metadata about those data sets so that we can make it available to just about anybody out there.
Brian, you've said that in the past you had a ton of fun during your early days as an IT entrepreneur. But much of what spawned that early innovation was collaboration with peers on how to build these better platforms for data sharing. Now you've shifted your skills to the public sector and you have an opportunity to help government help innovators, which you've euphemistically called an interesting challenge. So tell us about these unique and interesting challenges that you face in bringing public entities and bringing government into this 21st century exciting world of data sharing and IT innovation.
So the first thing I'll say is you should always beware when a geek calls a problem interesting, because that's usually code for very, very difficult. But, you know, I started my my career at a college basically writing code for a startup that I co-founded. And I'm a tech entrepreneur at heart. But one of the things that, you know, I think I realized in this role or in that world, I should say, is that success is really all about being able to accept risk and learn from mistakes. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges in the public sector is just the willingness to take on risk and the incentives that drive the ability to take on risk. If you think about the idea of innovation, either in technology or in any sense, it requires experimentation. And so I think if we want to innovate in the public sector, we need to learn how to take some chances. And my job is really to help people assume this risk. The other thing I would say is that, you know, governments in general are sort of large, somewhat ossified entities that have very established silos and walls between various programs and entities. And there's a huge amount of value that's trapped up in those silos. And you know, just from being here at HHS in the first couple of months that I've been on this job, I've seen examples of complementary programs that if they were connected and put together, we would, you know, be able to really drive some change in a big way. We can bring some of these people together. We can break down some of these walls. We can try to change that sort of paradigm that exists here and get things moving in a really positive direction.
You've also been engaged, maybe in Maryland, when you launched the program called Civic Commons, which inspired by an attempt to get more interconnectivity between the states and the governments. It seems to me it's sort of a virtual back end for states, if you will. Can you tell us more about how Civic Commons initiative works and sort of the policy behind it and what's the funding mechanism moving forward?
Yeah, so not just within organizations, but cross jurisdictions. People are working on pretty much the same thing over and over and over again. So if you look at, you know, cities, almost every city has to have a certain set of infrastructure that they need to create in order to operate that city effectively. And we end up not doing a good job of sharing some of those things. And you see this repeated over and over again as you go up the jurisdictional ladder. And so really what Civic Commons was, it's an attempt to provide a relatively frictionless platform for sharing not just code or applications, but also ideas or policies or funding methodologies in order to reduce the initial cost of development, reduce the cost of maintenance going forward, spread good ideas. That was the intention behind it.
Brian, it seems As we look back, the Obama administration made a pledge, and I think substantially has kept it, to continue to work on making government more open and more transparent. And one of the initiatives in keeping with this goal is a partnership between Health and Human Services and the Institute of Medicine to launch the Community Health Data Initiative, making the data more available to innovators and entrepreneurs. HHS recently participated in the Health Data Palooza Forum in Washington, D.C. Tell us about some promising innovations that are growing out of those efforts that were unveiled there.
Sure. So the Data Palooza started a couple of years ago with 40 people sitting in a room in a pile of data and a challenge to come back 90 days later with some interesting applications. It turned out that, you know, 90 days later, two dozen different applications were presented that, you know, showed us the potential for utilizing this data that we have. And it's grown ever since. The Data Palooza 3 that was just held at the Washington Convention Center in June of this year had 1,600 people. There were over 200 apps that applied to present. I mean, it's really been quite phenomenal. You know, a couple of good examples that have come out of this. There's a company called iTriage that we talk about a lot. This is a entity that was started by an ER doc, basically trying to use mobile applications to diagnose individuals based on certain symptoms that they were presenting. And then they leverage some of our data in order to help drive people to the right provider at the right time based on the diagnosis of those symptoms. They were actually bought by Aetna recently. They've got 80 people. They're growing. They're doing really well. And so that's a great example. Another good example is a company called Humetrics, which for those folks out there who've heard of this thing called Blue Button, basically there's this technology that we've been working on in conjunction with the Veterans Administration for the last couple of years, which allows people to click a little blue button on a website and get their personal health record. And so what Humetrics did was created an application called iBlueButton, which essentially takes this download of personal health data and translates it into a visual representation that's useful for the patient and for the doctor and for whoever else needs to see it.
We're speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic recently served as the Chief Innovation Officer for the State of Maryland and was Chief Technology Officer for the District of Columbia and is co-founder of several successful tech startups. Let's talk a little bit about innovation, and it seems to be central to the new paradigm at HHS. And in fact, the department just announced its fifth round of winners in the HHS Innovates program. And so for the first time, you had a People's Choice winner and allowed the public to vote on this. So can you share with us some of the more exciting innovations that came out of this program? And also, how much participation did you get from the public on this?
Sure. So, you know, as you said, this round we had the first iteration of the People's Choice Awards, which was pretty exciting. We let the world basically vote on the finalists.
By Twitter, or how did they vote?
No, they voted on the internet.
On the internet.
Yeah, we had a web page up on our site. But Twitter's a good idea. Maybe we'll do that next time. We actually had remarkable participation. It was kind of cool. Tens of thousands of votes were cast. And so it was really, I mean, it got a lot of people really involved, which was fantastic. One of the winners, actually, of this round, I think the story is pretty awesome. The National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases basically came out with this application they call Free Stuff. And it's a really simple idea, I think, but it's a very powerful idea. Basically, in the past, you'd have a bunch of stuff within the organization that people had bought over time that were either going to be replaced because they needed newer models or they didn't need anymore. And, you know, typically these things, whether it's like a piece of lab equipment or a piece of furniture, would go back into some warehouse in, you know, the middle of Maryland to sit there for a while until some, you know, government process actually took care of it. These guys realized that, you know, just because I didn't need this centrifuge anymore, somebody else might be able to use it. And so they put together essentially, think of it as Craigslist for, you know, government equipment, that a website that internal employees can actually look at.
Is there actually a big room like Raiders on the Lost Ark at the end where they find the Holy Grail? Is that?
in my imagination, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I hope that somewhere on one of those dusty shelves is an ark covered with a cloth. You know? But this story to me is pretty cool because basically the idea for this came up literally when this employee of this agency was out for a run one day, you know, and it just sort of hit her while she was running that, hey, this is a great idea. She goes back to the office, recruits a couple of people, and in their spare time, they put it together. And a little while later, you know, now it's being nominated for the HHS Innovates program, and it wins, and it's great. So that's a great example. Mm-hmm. Another great example, I think, is the Center for Disease Control's Zombie Apocalypse story. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but basically they used this marketing campaign of a zombie apocalypse for disaster readiness. And it won because I think it was very unique and different for governments to start marketing from this perspective. But the coolest thing happened to me the other day. I was on an airplane back from San Francisco to D.C., you know, and I was sitting there the whole flight working, putting my stuff away at the end. And the guy sitting next to me, he had seen me kind of working this whole time and asked me what I did. I told him my job. And he looked at me and says, I have one question. I said, what's that? He said, what are you guys doing about the zombie apocalypse?
Oh, really? That's great.
It blew my mind, right? Yeah. Because as a random guy living in Texas, you know, kind of on this airplane who had heard about this stuff and, you know, knew some of what we had been doing, which probably wouldn't have gotten out there had we not done a program like HHS Innovate. So I think these things really have some very significant effect.
Well, Brian, I have to tell you, the zombie apocalypse was a little bit like the Martian invasion in some communities where people did take it kind of seriously. But, you know, those are great ideas. One of the words that keeps coming up over and over in various manifestations is connect. And this is sort of central to the work that you're doing, it seems, connecting such disparate data that is stored and managed by HHS. And when you go to your healthdata.gov website, there's a nice visual there that links all these programs into a constellation: Medicare, Medicaid, the Center for Disease Control, and anybody can access the site and find all kinds of significant health data on numerous topics. So the question to me is, who's using the site and who's mining the data? Is it public health officials, clinicians, app inventors? Are you able to glean some intelligence on who's using the data in the public?
Well, we're working on that. I mean, we have a ton of anecdotal evidence that people across the spectrum are actually using healthdata.gov and doing interesting things with the information. But we are constantly working on engagement and trying to get other folks and different communities involved. In fact, one of the big efforts that we are undertaking right now is really one of kind of connecting different groups of people that don't typically think about health data or think about ways to do interesting things with health data and kind of bringing them into the fold. So, you know, I think in the past you've really needed to be a subject matter expert to understand a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to make some of these pieces of information more accessible. We're going to try to reach out to developer communities, to entrepreneurs, to venture capitalists, to providers, to, you know, any doctor out there. I mean, all of these different communities that we want to get involved. We're going to try to, you know, broaden the tent a little bit and get more and more folks involved. The neat thing is that since we launched healthdata.gov, I mean, we've had hundreds of thousands of visits on the site. We're constantly improving the functionality. We're absolutely open to feedback. I mean, I would stress one thing is that this is sort of, you know, I would slap a beta label on this in a lot of ways because mm-hmm. we are constantly looking at different things that we can do to make it more usable and more functional. And we're going to be doing some stuff around that in the near future. So keep your eyes on it.
Is that part of the government's new digital strategy? I know it's focusing on three things: making content more accurate, available, and secure. And you've been promoting application programming interfaces, or APIs, which are tools for building software. Applications is an important part of that process. So tell us about these APIs and why they're so important in securing meaningful use of government health data.
Sure. So basically what an API does is it allows a developer to access content and data in a machine-readable, but more importantly, a predictable way. So they can make a functional call to a service and actually get a piece of data back that they expect in a certain format, and then they can do something with it because it's in a certain format. You know, in the past, I think developers have had to resort to techniques called, for example, like screen scraping, where they literally try to, using these, you know, using a program, read what's on a screen. And that's obviously a very brittle way to do something, because if the format of the display changes, then we obviously have a challenge with, you know, having to update the program. So, you know, there's some great examples out there. I think one really quick one is an app called Healthline that was built basically using APIs that the National Library of Medicine puts out. And that's all about basically providing information to consumers, beneficiaries, about diseases and conditions and all kinds of stuff like that. And that's just one example. I mean, there mm-hmm. are plenty of other ones. And one of the components of the digital strategy is actually to API enable as much content and data as we possibly can to make this even easier for everybody.
We've been speaking today with Brian Civic, Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Health and Human Services. Mr. Civic continues the department's goal towards more open government and meaningful sharing of public health data so that we can harness the power of data, technology, and innovation to improve health and well-being of our nation. You can find out more about these innovation initiatives by going to healthdata.gov. Brian, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week we'll look at Mitt Romney's plan for pre-existing conditions. The Obama campaign has repeatedly said that Romney was wrong when he claimed at the first presidential debate that his plan covered pre-existing conditions, and we mostly agree with the campaign's criticism. Romney implied that he would keep the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, which guarantees access to coverage for all, regardless of pre-existing conditions and regardless if the person had been uninsured previously. But later, the Romney campaign explained that he was talking about protections only for persons who had had continuous coverage. Now, the 1996 HIPAA law did give protections to those with employer-sponsored coverage. Those workers can't be denied coverage, they can't be charged more, and if they've had previous employer-sponsored coverage, they get a waiver from any kind of exclusions to pre-existing conditions. But those going from an individual market plan, people who buy coverage on their own, to another individual plan, they don't have those same protections. So Romney could extend federal regulations for those individuals with continuous coverage. That means no gaps in coverage longer than 63 days. His campaign told us that he would extend federal HIPAA regulations, but did not offer specific details. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. The nation is battling an obesity epidemic, and it's hitting our children especially hard. Turns out, the very thing perceived to be one of the causes, the sedentary pastime of sitting in front of a screen playing video games, could provide a great solution. The folks at Hope Labs have cooked up another video game aimed at improving kids' health. They're the same folks who created Remission, a video game designed for kids with cancer to attack their cancer. Now comes Zamzi, a competitive video game designed to get kids moving. Hope Labs VP and Communications Director Richard Tate says it's a pretty simple concept. Equip kids with a movement monitor, which they plug into their computer at the end of the day, and compete against other kids on how much they move that day, and there are rewards for each kid based on their level of activity.
The Zamzi website uses sound principles of motivational science to get kids moving more. And the experience online is built in with a number of intrinsic rewards features, like positive game-like experiences where they experience success and feel competence and mastery for moving around. And that kind of positive experience keeps kids moving over time.
And as with their game Remission, when kids compete with a larger population, they're more inclined to want to succeed.
And there is a sense of discovery and excitement to see how many points you've earned for doing any number of activities, whether it's walking the dog, walking to school, even doing chores, or just running around with friends. And then with Zamzi, those points actually power your online experience. And points, it allows you to compare and compete with others on the site. And it actually can help earn you reward that keep you engaged and keep you moving.
And the results are significant. Kids playing the Zamzi video game moved an average 60% more per day than kids in the control group that didn't have the game at their disposal. A simple movement monitor connected to a competitive video game that could motivate millions of kids to move more during the day. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.